right, all right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yeah, it's a hell of a day today. I'm feeling very up for some reason, but we'll see how long that lasts. Yeah. We have a packed show today, and I'm really looking forward to jumping into it. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Stanley Cohen, a radical lawyer and human rights activist in New York City, on the recent resolution by the New York City Council against the BDS movement. All right, and it's going to be a very interesting conversation there, because Stanley's a ball of fire, okay? And he doesn't hesitate to tell the truth when he knows it's important, all right? Or anytime. Before that, we'll be talking with Heidi Brandenburg. Well, actually, it'll be a pre-recorded interview I did up at Sundance with Heidi Brandenburg, Matthew Orzel, and Tyra Akbar, the filmmakers of a film called When Two Worlds Collide, the story of the struggle of indigenous people in Peru against the Peruvian government and the imperialists behind them to extract oil, minerals, and gas from the Amazonian land. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show, Jerry Lemke. We just recently spoke with Jerry about his book on PTSD, Exposing PTSD. A very, very heavy, I still think a lot about that discussion. It was a very, very heavy conversation, a very heavy book. But Jerry's also the author of a number of books on vets and Vietnam, and in particular, a book called The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and Legacy of Vietnam. And it really digs into what was true about the reception that soldiers got when they came back from Vietnam, and what was true about the soldiers themselves, how they were viewing the war and what they were doing. And most recently, Jerry, as I would expect, jumped into a conversation that is extremely important, a conversation around Colin Kaepernick about his refusal to stand up and salute and sing or whatever the national anthem. Jerry's here to talk with us about his take on that. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Sure. Welcome back, I should say. There you go. We got a seat here that's marked Jerry Lemke, okay? So someday you have to come in and sit in it, all right? That'll be the... Yeah, there you go. We'll send a cab for you, Jerry. All right, well, let's jump into this. Your reaction to Colin Kaepernick's refusal to stand and sing the national anthem. Let's just tell people right off the bat, what was your reaction to that?
Well, my reaction wasn't so much to Kaepernick and what he did as it was to the reaction to Kaepernick, the number of people who drew on Vietnam veteran imagery and memory to either support Kaepernick, some people saying that, well, this is what veterans fought for, freedom of speech, freedom of people like Kaepernick to do what they're doing, or people who drew on veterans to make the opposite point, that by not standing for the national anthem, Kaepernick was insulting and degrading war veterans. And my response to that was to leave veterans, to leave military veterans out, first of all. It's an extension of a point that I've made before in things I've written, that if people support a war, they should support the war for reasons of the war, not because we sent people to fight the war. Or if you oppose the war, you should do that for reasons of the war itself, not because people have been put in harm's way. So war veterans get used too often, I think, as pawns in these kinds of arguments. And so in this case, I would say if you support what Kaepernick is doing, do it for reasons of that have to do more directly with his action and leave veterans out of it. The other thing, and maybe this goes more directly to the books that I've written, is that veterans used in this way become kind of passive figures in the story. And I've always remembered myself that Vietnam veterans came home from the war very much politicized and empowered by their wartime experience and very much agents of the making of their own story and the way the war would be remembered. And we came home very political. And the story I tell is my own experience with the flag at the time that I was being mustered out after having been to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. We're going to get into that in a couple of minutes, but I had a few other questions leading into that for you. And one was, you know, this point that you're making about how the discussion was cast, how the discussion was actually framed in terms of whether it was you were just weasels who were against the government and again weren't patriotic, or you had to stand and fight for, or had to welcome the vets who fought for the right for Kaepernick to stand up and anybody else to stand up and say, well, we're not going to do this. And you actually, as you're pointing out here, there's something really missing here. And you cite One other person who I thought brought another angle into it, but still there was something I think a little bit missing to it, and that was Rory Fanning. Who could you tell people who he was? Because that's a whole different take on things, I think.
Yeah, well, he's an Iraq War veteran who wrote an article in Jacobin, which is another magazine, and he too supports. He supports Kaepernick and what Kaepernick did. And my point there was that Fanning, as a war veteran, ought to take then his support for Kaepernick. He ought to take that into action of his own and take that message to other people who are still in the military to protest against the militarization and the false uses of our military for these actions abroad, like in Iraq and Afghanistan, and take that protest inside the military itself. And that's the point that I've tried to make with Vietnam veterans, that during the war in Vietnam, of course, some of us supported the moratorium against the war in 1969, and we supported what people were doing back in the States to oppose the war. But we also took that sentiment inside the military itself, and there were people in Vietnam, in the field in Vietnam, who refused to take orders, you know, for action during those days of the moratorium back home. So it wasn't just in support of what somebody else was doing. We did it in support of ourselves, in a sense. We took action, direct action, in support of ending the war and ending the conflict in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's something else that you bring up in the article you wrote, which was the article is called Taking a Knee for Peace, Recalling the Veterans Who Sat. There's something that you bring up in that I was really struck by, because you basically say, look, the gap in the discussion of patriotism and there's a gap in the discussion of patriotism and symbols like the national anthem and the flag. And there's like actually that point about what does all this mean, and that in your experience during Vietnam, vets not only supported other people protesting, but they often did it themselves. A lot of that had to do with uncovering or peeling away the mythology and the lies about what is the character of the system, what does patriotism mean in a situation like that? These symbols, what do they mean? What are they done for? And that's a discussion that is not being had and needs to be had today.
Well, one of the things that I say in the piece that I wrote, which is on commondreams.com, by the way, if people want to check that out, is that we in Vietnam, we reacted to this slogan that we're there to defend the flag or we're there to fight for the flag. And we turned that slogan around, and oftentimes in Vietnam, I heard it said, we're stuck in this situation in Vietnam because of the flag, because of the ill-conceived kind of patriotism that goes on back home, back in the States. You know, that's the kind of stuff that's gotten us stuck in Vietnam. And so we need to kind of reinterpret what these symbols like the flag and the national anthem really stand for and what they mean. And they don't mean, certainly there was a conclusion that I came to in Vietnam, we're not fighting for freedom, our freedom or anybody else's freedom, when we're fighting in these wars. And we really have to kind of reinterpret that history and discern what other meanings of these symbols have and what the consequences of those meanings are.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Jerry Lemke. Jerry's the author of many books, including the book The Spitting Image, which I've read a number of times, Jerry. And he's also an associate professor emeritus of sociology at Holy Cross College. Jerry, let's talk about this a little bit more, because you also say that there's a, you know, when you were talking about bringing this back, bringing what you know back into the armed forces, you say there that this was actually something that was not uncommon during Vietnam when you were there. It was actually not uncommon for people to have there was widespread active duty resistance and rebellion that people don't even hear about today.
Oh, that's right. And I do say in the piece that one thing that people should see if they haven't is the film Sir, No Sir, which is a 2006 documentary that kind of uncovers and recovers that history of GI dissent within the military. And we try to you know, bring that message to people in the military today, people who are in Iraq and Afghanistan. And there was some success for that. There was an organization called Iraq Veterans Against the War that spun off as a result of that. But it hasn't really reached the level that it did during the wars in Vietnam. And I think that's something that has to we have to keep working on that. And a lot of this is not disconnected, by the way, with the issues that Colin Kaepernick is raising about young black men being shot by police, by city police. There's a real interlock between the militarization of our culture in general and the militarization of the police in our cities. And a good book for people to see if they haven't is Jeremy Kuzmaroff's book entitled Modernizing Repression. And he documents the tie-in between the military, the militarization that goes on in the society in general and the military training that goes on not only within this country, but that we've taken abroad to other countries, and the tie-ins with that with the militarization of our police forces. And so, you know, a point that could be made that others of us could make springing off of what Kaepernick has done is that the militarization of professional football, you know, the military flyovers, the almost ridiculous displays of flags covering whole football fields, the display of the flag with honor guards marching and so forth, all of that is pretty easy to tie in then with what's going on in our city governments and our city police forces with their militarization and the, you know, the hyping up of the military hardware that they have and so forth, and then the shooting of a young men in our streets. So that's a rather short step that we could take to move beyond what Kaepernick has done, or use really what Kaepernick has done to make some bigger and broader points.
Mm-hmm. Now let's move into your experience yourself, because you were confronted with what were you going to do when you came back from Vietnam, and you were confronted with a lot of things that had been told you to expect, and what you actually determined yourself you were going to do. Let's tell people that story.
Yeah, well, as I said already, lots of us in Vietnam came to say that, well, we're here because of the flag, not for the flag. So there was some talk in Vietnam about, you know, I'll never stand for the flag again, or I'll never sing the national anthem again. But we also knew that when we got back to the States, and some of us actually were processed out of the military at the time that we landed back in the States. That was the case with me. And you know, we knew that, gosh, when that happens, you know, we're going to have to stand and salute the flag one last time and maybe say the Pledge of Allegiance and sing the national anthem. And what am I going to do? I had some apprehension about that, you know, as I hit stateside. And I say in the piece that I wrote that it was kind of a gut check for me. It was a kind of, okay, guy, you know, you said all these big things when you were with your buddies back in Vietnam, and now you're alone. Now you're going to be ushered into this room with a bunch of people that you don't know, you've never met before, and they're all going to stand up and salute the flag. And what, you know, what are you going to do? So, you know, I really didn't know. And then the scene did unfold just as we were told that it would and as we thought it would. And as I wrote in the piece, in that split second where I had to make a decision about do I sit or I stand, nobody stood. Nobody. I was in a room of 10 or 20 other people who also had just arrived back in the States from Vietnam and who were being processed out. Not a single guy, not a single veteran, now veteran or soon to be veteran of the war in Vietnam, stood up. And the officer in charge just went right ahead. And the national anthem did play. And I suppose he sang. I don't remember for sure. but the rest of us did not, and we just sat. And it occurred to me, I think probably then, and it certainly does looking back on it, that probably that had become pretty routine by then, because that officer didn't seem a bit fazed by it. It seemed as though it was something that he had seen before, and he had expected it, and he never batted an eye. And I, again, going in, you know, I thought the punishments for this could actually be pretty severe, that, you know, maybe they would keep us there at Fort Lewis in Washington, where we were being processed through. You know, maybe they would keep us, and it may be a worse, gosh, you know, maybe I get sent back to Vietnam or something. Yeah, so I really didn't know. And I thought at the time that I was taking a pretty serious risk. As it turned out, apparently not so. But for a long time after that, I didn't stand for the national anthem. I think quite a few Vietnam veterans did not. I mean, it might have been a minority for sure, but I think it was a sizable minority. And it's a very different, that paints a very different picture of war veterans than what we get out of either side of the use of war veterans now, supporting Kaepernick or opposing Kaepernick. It's almost a kind of a third voice, I think. And it occurred to me as I was writing this piece that is what I'm providing. It's a, you know, it's a still different take. Veteran take on the Kaepernick affair.
Mm-hmm. We have time enough for one more question, Jerry, and it's one that I want you to, you can just range around in for a while, because there's a point here that, just building off of what you just said, you know, you've dedicated your life to actually making sure that lost history doesn't stay lost, or that buried history doesn't stay buried. And to me, you know, it's an extremely important thing, because you, even starting from what you mentioned in the piece you wrote about how the national anthem, you know, basically the history of the national anthem, and we're made to believe that this has always been a vital part, you know, a part of the you know, it's wrapped around your vertebrae and it's your backbone, and it's sort of, there's everything about America has the national anthem at its heart. And, you know, you expose the fallacy behind that, but you also, more than that, you actually have paid a lot of attention to recovering lost history and bringing out the reality of what happened and what's going on today. Let's talk about the importance of that.
Well, I think other people have written very, very well about the history of the flag and the national anthem, and pointing out that it's really not all that deep in American history. And one of the things that I remember is it never being played in my high school in the 1950s for sports events, and even later in the 1960s. I played baseball in college, and I'm quite sure that the national anthem was never played there. So, I mean, that's part of that history, and again, other people have written about that in other kinds of ways. But I've also been been real keen on writing about the war resistance, the resistance of people within wars, and the resistance of veterans to wars, and the fallacy of stories about anti-war people spitting on veterans. That was the source of my 1998 book, as you've mentioned. So those are all the kinds of themes that I try to develop in the books that I write.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jerry, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thanks again for having me.
Sure. And where can people read your piece again on the Kaepernick and the Taking a Knee for Peace, Recalling Veterans Who Sat? Where can they read again, Common Dreams?
It's at commondreams.com.
All right, Jerry. And I look forward to talking to you again. I just got your book on Jane Fonda, and I'm going to be reading that, and we're going to call you again and have you on the air about that one too, okay?
That would be a real good one.
That'll be fun. All right, Jerry. Look forward to talking to you again, man. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we were just talking with Jerry Lemke, the author of numerous books exposing the reality behind the U.S. war machine and what they the lies that they tell, but also why it's so important to understand that and to recover things like lost history. And Jerry is also an associate professor emeritus of sociology at Holy Cross College. And the book that he's most known for is it's called The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam. All those stories you heard about how soldiers coming back from Vietnam were spit on by long-haired hippies and as they got off the plane in the middle of a fort in Washington somewhere, right, that somehow hippies managed to infiltrate the fort. Okay, what does that say? We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Amazon from Billy Higgins, Bob Berg, Cedar Walton, and Tony Dumas. And it's an appropriate song for this next segment because we're going to be listening to an interview I did up at Sundance six months ago or so, with Heidi Brandenburg, Matthew Orzel, and Tyra Akbar, the filmmakers of a film called When Two Worlds Collide, the story of the struggle of indigenous people in Peru against the Peruvian government's attempts to extract oil, minerals, and gas from untouched indigenous Amazonian land. And understand this, that right behind the Peruvian government were all the big multinational corporations that are based in the U.S., Europe, and elsewhere, all right? So you can pay attention to that as we're talking about this. Now, what I should say first is that you need to see this movie. You really need to see this movie. It opened up officially in August, and it just recently opened in Los Angeles, and it's going to be playing in theaters all over the country over the next few months. Now, you can find out about a showing in your area at their website, WhenTwoWorldsCollideMovie.com. Once again, that's WhenTwoWorldsCollideMovie.com. Go to that website, look for when and where it might be playing close to you. And if it's not playing close to you, write to them and see if you can get a copy of it to show to people in your area. You can also go to their Facebook page for the same reason. And you can find out news about the movie and the struggle in the Amazon and helpful links to be informed and get involved if you want to at their Facebook page and on their website. So once again, their website is WhenTwoWorldsCollideMovie.com, and you can go to their Facebook page as well. Right now, we're going to jump right into the interview I did with him back at Sundance when I first saw the film. So check this out. All right. One of the first films, actually the first film I saw at Sundance this year, was When Two Worlds Collide. And it was a really remarkable film that I've been thinking about ever since I saw it. And I'm joined today by the director of the film, who's Heidi Brandenburg.
Heidi Brandenburg, yes.
And a producer from the film, Tyra Akba.
Yes, hi.
And the other director. And your name is Matthew Orzel. So welcome, guys. Tell people what the film is about briefly, and then what was it that compelled you to make this film?
Okay, so this film is about a human tragedy of a deadly battle that happened in the Peruvian Amazon. In the film, you see on one hand is the Peruvian government that wants development and prosperity, and on the other hand, there are the indigenous people that want to protect the rainforest and the land they need for their survival. So in the film, ultimately, you're going to follow the political upheaval that led to the conflict and the fallout that happened afterwards, and the audience were left to judge the truth of themselves.
What compelled you to make the film?
Heidi and I studied at university together and made some film projects, and after we graduated we decided to do another project. Tyra, our close friend, she had similar interests in us and a passion for storytelling, so we all decided to create a production company called Yachaywasi Films. I previously had been to Peru and was fascinated by the culture and visually stunned by the landscape. And Heidi is Peruvian, so it kind of just made sense to make that our next destination to look for a story.
I was actually going to ask you about that because I saw that you had spent a lot of time in Peru, but you were born there?
I was born actually in Paraguay, but my mother is Peruvian and I grew up in Peru until I was 8 years old.
Yeah. Well, tell me this. What was a point to turn things in Peru? Because Peru has been a center of a lot of stuff over the last 20, 30, 40 years. And there was a point that was made in some of the notes that came with your film about the turning point for a lot of what is going on in Peru today involved the signing of the U.S.-Peru Free Trade Act.
So what had happened and how we came to find the story was we came across a newspaper article, and it was basically saying that a Peru-U.S. free trade agreement had just been signed, and just within a very short amount of time, around 75% of the Amazon was opened up for big investment, a big business. So what really had happened is that the Peruvian government took advantage of the free trade agreement to bring out a series of laws that was basically threatening the indigenous people and their livelihoods.
When you say threaten their livelihoods, how?
Well, it was opening up the Amazon for even more big investment and for more oil and gas companies to come in and explore for oil and gas.
One of the things that you bring out in your film, which is, it really struck me very heavy, because there's this whole point of, this was a dramatic leap, you know, that there had been damage to the Amazon area.
So when we read this newspaper article, we were very curious of how this is going to affect the indigenous people. And at that time, it was a major outcry amongst them. And so we started travel. We started traveling into the Amazon, and we went to an area where they've already had 40 years of oil exploitation, and we became witnesses of massive oil spills and how this was affecting their lives. You know, it was changing everything for them. They were very poor, even though they had oil exploitation for 40 years. There were no animals, there was no food. I mean, even us who were coming from Lima, we were hungry. I mean, we didn't know what to eat. And we thought, oh my God, if these people don't have, their water is contaminated, their food, there isn't any food, how are they going to survive? And if more companies are going to come into Peru, what is going to happen? So we had anticipated that this wasn't going to end well, but we had no idea that a protest will follow and that this would lead up to this major conflict in which indigenous and police officers would get killed.
Just to give people a greater sense of the damage done by oil, by mining, that kind of thing. There were some really moving scenes you had in your film where people were talking about the water in the river, and they were lifting their hand down and they were lifting up gobs of oil.
You know,
it was like, I mean, it was incredible. And then you would see that, you know, you think about the danger, the damage done to the Amazon overall right now and how much of it is disappearing. And then if it's going to be ratcheted up full force in Peru, what's that going to add to it? It just seemed that an entire, both poisoning the people, you know, it's poisoning the people, and but it's also destroying a lifestyle that's been going on for a long time, not just a lifestyle, but a way of life, that's been going on for a long time. And that has massive repercussions across the board.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. You know, when you do travel to the Amazon, especially in these areas where they've had oil exploitation for so many years, I mean, a lot of people are sick. They have stomach pain. They have lead in their blood. You know, they become very sick. They go constantly to the local clinic, and I mean, it really does change our lives completely.
And also for me, I think there's definitely two parallel worlds that are gaining from what's happening in the Amazon. You know, you have Lima that is now, there's been huge development over the last 8 years, even since we've been there, we've seen a massive transformation. But then you look at what's happening in the Amazon and you see what they have. It's just, you can't compare the two worlds. It's just very, there's no justice. And like Heidi said, this particular community that we went to in the Rio Corrientes had exploitation for almost 40 years. And they do not have fresh water. They do not have the ability to really grow food, because many of the areas have now been contaminated by oil. And that was one of the main reasons that we continue to do this story.
Mm-hmm. Also at the time, nobody was talking about the contamination in Peru, because these places are really far away. They're really hard to get to. And on top of it, you're in a rainforest. Everything grows over one another. I mean, it is, you know, it's hard to see sometimes unless you really go inside, unless you dig really out and to see what's beneath the soil.
And even when they do the cleanup, they're not using advanced machinery, and there's always still oil there. It's never cleaned up 100%. They just make a little effort to do anything about it.
One particular place where we witnessed, they just, to basically clean up the oil, they digged a massive, huge hole. in the soil, and they were just basically bringing all the, you know, oil and putting them right in there. You know, it's like, and then turning it around. I have no idea, but it was just ridiculous.
Yeah. And then that just goes into the rivers again. It's because it's just not cleaned up properly.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with the filmmakers of an important new documentary called When Two Worlds Collide. The film's all about the devastation of the Peruvian Amazon and the people that live in it. And while it tells the story of this destruction and devastation and the fight against it, it also points a finger at the imperial powers behind it.
Now, you're faced with this situation, and actually, one thing I'd have to ask is, when you went to Peru, you didn't go necessarily looking for this particular contradiction, did you? No. So how did you come onto that? I mean, how did that actually smack you in the head and say, you got to do something about this?
Yeah, I mean, in 2009, we started following Alberto's story. Alberto Pisango is the leader of all the indigenous groups or communities in Peru, and he's our main character in the story. And he guides us through the film. So we met him about 2 months before the conflict happened.
I mean, when we traveled in the Amazon rainforest and we became witnesses of these massive oil spills, this is what really then drove us to wanting to make the film and show the destruction in the Amazon, show how the indigenous people are affected by it and how this changes their lives. And that's when we really started to, like, you know, develop the story further. And it wasn't until 2009 that we met Alberto Pisango.
Let's talk about that. How did you meet him?
We heard about an indigenous gathering where all indigenous leaders from every community of Peru from the Peruvian Amazon would come and elect their new representative. At that time, their representative was Alberto Pisango, and it happened that he was being reelected. And we approached him and we wanted to congratulate him, and he seemed like he wasn't very excited about being reelected. And we asked him, well, why? You should be really excited about this. And he's just like, you know what? I am. But at the same time, I would like to go back to my family. I would like to be home and go back into the rainforest, because that's where I really feel, you know, at home. And he was living at that time in Lima, because from Lima, you have to represent the rights of the people because you have to go to Congress, you know. And anyways, and we found him very captivating. He was very selfless, very relentless in wanting to continue to represent the rights of his people. And that was really the turning point where we decided, you know what, we need to tell the story about this man, because he really gives everything up to, you know, to represent the rights of his people.
Now, part of the story of Alberto also involves Alan Garcia, who's the other major figure in your film beyond the people who are rebelling and whatnot. But there's this Alan Garcia played a certain role. Let's talk about that a little.
So we found Garcia very fascinating, because when we started researching the story, not only did we come across an article where we read about the Peru-US Free Trade Agreement, but we also came across an article that Garcia wrote himself. And he was basically talking about a Greek fable called The Dog and the Manger. And The Dog and the Manger basically was talking about how the dog wouldn't want to share the manger with the horses. And he compared that fable to the indigenous people in Peru, basically saying that there's so many riches in the Peruvian Amazon, but yet the indigenous people don't want to share those riches with the rest of Peru. And we found that, like, shocking that he would compare the indigenous people to that fable. And that's really what drove us to also look at who Garcia is, what he wanted to do, and then brought him into the film. And when the protest happened, you can see in the film that he wasn't trying to talk about it in a diplomatic way. He was basically looking down at the indigenous people, calling them, you know, they're not first-class citizens. We're not going to let a handful of people decide what the country and or how the country should develop. So, I mean, that's what really caught our attention, and that's why we brought him into the story as well.
The thing that people should know is that Alan Garcia is the president of Peru.
Yes, at that time he was the president of Peru, and now he's going to be running for presidency again in 2016.
Yeah, and it's interesting because many years ago he was considered the liberal hope in Peru.
Yes. You know?
Now, Heidi, you just set up the idea that Alan Garcia was becoming, he emerged as the one side of this contradiction. And on the other side was Alberto Pisango, but it was also just a whole gigantic indigenous population, right? Millions of people that were actually demanding that they wanted their rights, they wanted their land, they wanted the protection of their culture. Now this developed into a fierce struggle. How did you get access to all this? Because you have some remarkable access to this. You guys went places that other people don't normally necessarily go.
Essentially, Alberto gave us the opportunity to go everywhere in the Amazon. He's the representative of all the communities throughout, and he led the way.
I mean, knowing Alberto, and since he was the leader of all the indigenous tribes all across the Amazon, he paved the way for us to get access.
Was there anything in particular that struck you immediately about the sides that were lining up?
I mean, it was extraordinary, you know. The people were uprising against the government, and they wanted those laws to be repealed because it was threatening their environment and their livelihoods.
At one point, this massive struggle erupted. What was the flashpoint there? What was it that set that on fire, that allowed, that made that erupt, that kind of struggle, that roads were being blocked, all kinds of fighting was breaking out?
So Congress was meant to get together on the 4th of June and repeal those laws. Half of the Congress people didn't even show up. And in the end, they didn't repeal the law. And not only indigenous people were waiting, but also the police officers were waiting because they wanted to go home. You know, everybody wanted to go home and end this protest peacefully. When Congress didn't repeal the law, I mean, that was like a huge disappointment to the indigenous community. But again, they wanted to go. I mean, even after the laws weren't repealed, they were going to retreat. They had no idea that the government would come in the morning and then block the roads and with force.
And just so people know, without going deeply into it and ruining the movie, but just so people know, this struggle actually developed into something huge because the government was pushing, people were not going to back down, and then there was a confrontation between the police and the people, right?
Yes, there was a confrontation between the police and the indigenous people. But, you know, here again, the police officers had to follow their duty. They were sent by the Peruvian government to unblock the roads, but, you know, unfortunately, it just ended up in this deadly conflict, which it's something that it should have never gotten to that. But I want to say something here is that we set out to make a film about the indigenous people and the destruction of the Amazon. But when we realized that not only the indigenous got killed, but also police officers, we realized, you know what? This is a story about the human element. No, this is a story where everybody loses, not just the indigenous, but also the police. Everybody that lives in that same country is affected. And in the end, even the government lost out because of their image internationally.
I think, you know, essentially both sides were disillusioned by the same leader.
Let's deal with one more question, okay, which is the point that was made in your film where I think actually, is it the father of one of the police that was killed?
Yes.
And he says, as he's out there and he's looking out, I don't know, in the forest or something, he's looking out and he says, what kind of world is it when a drop of oil or a piece of gold is worth more than a human life? And it really struck me for that to come out. It just sort of jumped out after all of this. It jumped out in the film, and it was something that really makes you think. What do you think about that?
I mean, this man, even though he suffered so much, he was never able to find his son. All he wanted was really to have something to bury him and have find closure. And even though he went through all that pain, he did understand the bigger picture. You know, he did travel to the Amazon to find his son, and he saw firsthand how poor the people were, how they had no food. And so he understand why these people went out there in the first place. He really, really understood what was happening. He also knew how corrupt the government was. So this was his conclusion. And that's just, I mean, it's just unbelievable how somebody like that, who suffered so much, can still see beyond and understand the bigger picture.
Where do things stand today?
Even though Law 1090 was repealed, this didn't stop the government to bring up new laws in 2014 that basically does the same thing, weakening indigenous land rights, weakening environmental regulation, and it didn't stop them to keep developing in the Peruvian Amazon.
Do you have any idea of who are the main oil corporations that are developing things in Peru?
I mean, there are various oil companies from different parts of the world. You know, you have from Argentina, you have some from Canada, you have some from the U.S., you have some from Spain. I mean, there are various own companies involved. But I want to say here that it's not only oil companies that are posing a threat to reproving Amazon. It's mining, gold mining, it's illegal logging. You know, it's just many other things that are a problem and are threatening. Infrastructure, for example, you know, the major highway that was built between Brazil and Peru, that has just brought a huge amount of immigration from Brazil or different parts of Peru that are basically building homes right around the highway, and it's deforesting major parts of the Amazon.
What has happened to Alberto Bizanga?
So he's still ongoing the trial along with 52 other indigenous people. And
the trial for what?
It's the trial for Curva, for the protests. I'm part of the protests, sorry. Alberto is facing life in prison.
All right, folks, thank you very much. All right, enjoyed talking with you.
And we conducted that interview before Alberto's trial was concluded, and so we didn't know that much about what actually was going to happen to Alberto. But you can find all that out by going to the website of the movie. Once again, that's whentwoworldscollidemovie.com. And again, you can go there to find out what's happened overall with Alberto's case, what's happened with the struggle, and you can look for screenings and other news around the film. And if you want to search for news about Alberto, his name is Alberto Bizanga, P-I-Z-A-N-G-O. So with that information, you ought to be able to find out what he's up to and what's happening with the struggle. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Is Palestine by Peter Liam Holcross. Just recently, I happened to be just frantically digging through all kinds of magazines, newspapers, and all kinds of information sources, and I came across something that really caught my eye in Counterpunch, actually. And it was a story about Stanley L. Cohen. Stanley's a lawyer in New York who modeled himself, or was inspired by William Kunstler, and Stanley has spent his lifetime really fighting, you know, against injustice for just causes. And actually, he's a voice to be reckoned with. All right? And most recently, he took on the New York City Council in an article entitled "Boycotts Now and Then: An Open Letter on BDS to the City Council of New York." Stanley Cohen, welcome to the show.
Thanks so very much for inviting me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely, man. Well, let's jump into this. The New York City Council recently held a meeting to discuss the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement, and moves to silence it. What was going on there? And what led to the meeting and what was going on?
Oh, it was a quid pro quo. I mean, the initial almost knee-jerk response was, it's AIPAC, it's the Jewish lobby in New York City, but it really was not about that. This was a quid pro quo, where the city council person, the Madam Speaker, as I call her, who has been very supportive of, if not independence, but certainly justice for Puerto Rico, and I share that concern, has been active in trying to obtain a commutation for a former FALN leader from President Obama, and she wanted a resolution passed by the city council urging that the commutation occur, and she approached the Jewish collective or caucus in the city council, and they cut a deal. And she said, all right, I'll move the Black and Latino and Asian community, the caucus, to support an anti-BDS movement or resolution, and you support my commutation bill, and we'll get this thing done. And that's what it was about.
But Stanley, here's a question for you. Here's a question for you, because, you know, if you look at this all across the country, and I know we've covered this out here quite a bit, and just recently, Stanley Adelson, for instance, has just given truckloads of money to people like David Horowitz, to the Maccabee movement, to all these people who are out to basically crush the BDS movement and to crush all other forms of support for the Palestinian people in opposition to the Israeli government and Israel. And, you know, it's very heavy. I mean, we interviewed a guy last week, a young student at UCLA, who was going into a supermarket and saw a poster on the wall, and all of a sudden he saw his name and he realized that he was being called out as a Jew hater. You know, and you provided a very, very interesting description of what happened in that city council meeting, because they did come after the BDS movement. It wasn't just sort of like, you know, well, here's a quid pro quo, but there was actually, they really went full-scale assault on the BDS movement in that meeting.
Well, look, they did. But, you know, there's something that's interesting that hasn't really peaked yet. The anti-BDS move that is funded by AIPAC and that is funded by Israel and is funded by Adelson, which has been an attack on academic freedom and on organizations, it's in its early stages. I have no doubt in my mind when the resolutions that are being passed, the statutes that have been embraced, and these edicts that are being handed down eventually see the light of day in terms of constitutional challenge, they're going to lose. There's not a doubt in my mind, and I don't think you're going to find anyone who is a constitutional expert or someone who spent his or her life litigating First Amendment issues who's going to end up taking a different position. So at this point, it's PR, and it's ugly, and it's vicious, and it's been physical. And yes, you know, the BDS supporters were physically removed from the city council meeting. And yes, there have been attacks, and there have been students that have been suspended and faculty members who have lost their jobs. And there is a full-scale effort by Israel and its surrogates in the United States and in Europe to challenge the BDS movement because it's afraid of it. Because it is a peaceful vehicle by which it can make a profound impact in support of Palestinian justice and liberation and equality. And yes, the city council meeting was ugly, and I didn't mean to minimize it by talking about a quid pro quo. It was, and the police were called in, and a preliminary vote was taken, and there is a full vote taking place in the next week to 10 days. And I understand is my piece may play a little role, because it's starting to make its way around the New York City Council. And it's a piece that speaks about the tradition, the history of dissent in New York City. The City Council in the past, it really was the first major attack on apartheid in South Africa, came out of the New York City Council. And we have always stood ahead of the times. City Council has always been activist when it comes to issues of international human rights and liberty and justice, both at home and abroad. And here has been a complete about change in the very state where it was signed off on by Mario Cuomo's son. But again, I mean, you have to separate. There's the de facto intimidation that's going on, where academics are frightened, where students are being suspended, where there are retaliation going on. As you pointed out, someone who saw his name on a list on the wall, there's that. And there's the de jure, there's the legal issue. And I have little doubt that as issues arrive, as they become ripe, as people begin to get what we call in the law standing, there will be challenges and BDS will be upheld.
You know, it's interesting. It's
protected speech.
It's very interesting, though, because, you know, when you look at even the things like the laws that are being passed, I think Cuomo actually passed this law about going after corporations that are influenced by or begin to do things in agreement with the BDS campaign. And that's happening all over the country. Now, one of the things that you said, which I was really intrigued by this, man, you said you equated the shroud of supremacy worn by Reichstag supporters of the 30s at a time when today's Palestinians were yesterday's Jews. You've equated what was going on at that meeting as that shroud of supremacy worn by Reichstag supporters at a time when today's Palestinians were yesterday's Jews. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, no, the victims have become the victimizers. The same type of mindless mob mentality that resulted in the 30s, in the rise of fascism, the rise of attacks on people just because of their religion or because of their ethnicity or because of their speech, is taking place in this point, in this time, in this place, in this country. And while I was not at the meeting, I spoke to a half dozen people that participated, including a couple of rabbis that were singled out and were spat upon and were called self-hating Jews and fraudsters. And what came to my mind was the Night of the Kristol. What came to my mind was here we are 85 or 70 years later, whatever it is now, and history is once again repeating itself. It was ugly. It was vicious. It was a mob mentality. It's the kind that is taking place, you're right, across this country, where people are afraid to speak out, where people are afraid to participate, where people are going to demonstrations and being harassed and being physically assaulted, are being called the worst possible things, where children of activists are being singled out and intimidated. It is history repeating itself. In many respects, when it comes to the issue of not just BDS, but when it comes to the issue of justice for Palestine, when it comes for free speech, when it comes for association, when it comes to the right to be a dissident and to dissent, we're beginning to see, and it's not just the early stages, we're well into the 30s in Germany. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a guy who's a conspiracy theorist. I don't say that easily, but I've been around long enough and I've been an activist and an attorney. You know, I'm going on fifth now. You know, 1969 was the first time I got beat up by cops at a demonstration involving Vietnam. I've been around long enough now to see where we've come from and where we are at, where I didn't use that phrase lightly, and I believe it.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, too, because as I'm sitting here, I'm thinking about this thing, even in relation to what happens in relation to Israel, where this whole question of Israel, whether there's support for Israel or not, is totally, Israel, it's couched in something bigger. It's actually part of something much bigger, which is that Israel is totally necessary for the U.S. control of the Middle East itself. And that really does trump any kind of constitutional niceties that may or may not be violated. You know, that's a backbone point around what's going on with this, because you're seeing this happening over and over and over again. I mean, the campus tour that David Horowitz is going to go on now, and the nationwide tour that he's going to go on to basically delegitimize the Palestinian people and legitimize Israel as a state and its right to actually be the entire state.
You know? Listen, Horowitz was a fraud as a leftist, and he's a fraud and a huckster while he's going to do this tour. I've debated him. I've argued with him. He's like Dershowitz. He's like the other quote-unquote liberals that have seen the light, that at the end of the day are filled with hatred. Mm-hmm. And you've hit it right in the head, because I've written a bunch of pieces, and in fact I've litigated this issue before. Israel gets away with what Israel gets away with because they're our proxy in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
For 70 years they've played that role of our point. Regional instability is their best friend. We are now talking about going on $200 billion, mostly for weapons. What Israel wants, Israel gets. And it's interesting because while at the same time that Obama's been getting beaten up by some people for being anti-Netanyahu or anti-Israel, the reality of it is he's given Israel more money than any president in the history of this country.
He just sent him a basketful of money recently. It was like huge.
$40 billion over 10 years, and it doesn't stop them from coming back for discretionary funding. All they have to do is jump up and down and scream they're coming for us.
Right. Now, let's one last thing, and we have about 3 minutes to get into this. You talked about the importance of sending a message to the people of Israel that silence in the face of what's been done and is being done to the Palestinian people is complicity. That's an extremely important point, I think, to be bringing out to the people of Israel. Let's talk about that for about 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, the day of saying I didn't know, like many Germans did after World War II, is done. Israel knows what's going on. Israelis know what's going on. Apartheid and occupation and extrajudicial assassinations and closing of universities and attacks on NGOs is very visible. The ugly settler strain is on the front page of every newspaper every day in Israel. To be silent is to be complicit. You can't turn around and say, I didn't know. You can't passively sit and watch these violations of international law and human rights unfold and to sit back removed and say, not my thing. The message we got out of judgment in Nuremberg in 1945 was there is no such thing as being silenced in the presence of war crimes and of genocide. And that's what's going on, and every single Israeli is accountable. Those that may be pulling the trigger and those that are saying nothing while the trigger is being pulled.
Stanley, that's a tremendously strong and important way to end this interview, and I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me. Love your show, and keep it up.
And we'll talk to you again soon, man. All right?
Thank you.
All right. Take care, Stanley. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Stanley Cohen, radical lawyer and human rights activist, on a recent resolution by New York City's council against the BDS movement. In fact, they're calling in the police to drag the BDS supporters and members out of the meeting and all of these things that have been going on. And this is something that people need to pay attention to. Actually, I want to hear from people who've been listening to this today. Write to us at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Write to us and let us know what you think about what's happening with all this, all right? What you think about the questions that were posed here, and particularly about this last question and a couple of the questions. It really posed things before us and before people everywhere about where do you stand in a world that is just full of repression, oppression, genocide, and all this. Where do you take your stand, all right? I want to thank all of my guests today, Jerry Lemke, the directors and co-directors of the film When Two Worlds Collide, and Stanley Cohen. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Matt Kwiklinski and Jeff Pryor. And I really want to say thank you to Kiana Turner, my board op for today. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Stan from Sly and the Family Stone. And once again, check us out on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, all right? So let's keep this thing rolling. Right now, it's Sly Stone and Stan.
Things you want are real.
You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
There's a midget standing tall,
and the giant beside him about to fall. Crawl, and they know what you're saying makes sense at all.